Whoa, yeah, slow down, baby. Let you know from the gate, this train is crazy. Got the terms of the year, just pulled them lately. Gonna drop them right here, buckle up for safety. Cause what you know about the debt ceiling, T-bills and bricks? Racketeering's always here, cause Rico's got tricks are for kids and ex-presidents. Bank failures had those, setting new precedents. Treasury's got your back if your bank goes under, but not your crypto tokens when your broker gets plundered. Did you buy a CD when the yield curve was inverting? Or assume a mortgage when the 30-year was burning 8%, nobody was buying a home? And AI is threatening to take everything we own. It's been a year to remember some things we'd like to repress. We're searching for the American dream on the Investopedia Express. Welcome back and welcome aboard. A choppy week for stocks, but the momentum continued with a big rally on Friday that brought the S&P 500 to its highest close of the year and its highest level since March of 2022. Don't call it a comeback, but what else are you going to call it? You could call it a 20% gain for the year for the benchmark index, because that's what it is, and it's also a six-week winning streak for the S&P and the Dow 30. Last Friday's jobs report for the month of November, which showed a gain of 199,000 jobs and the unemployment rate sliding to 3.7%, only reaffirmed what a lot of investors hope is happening: a soft landing, a slowing economy, but one that is still growing, and a labor market that remains very strong. This was one of the last pieces of economic data the Fed will look at it before it meets on interest rates this week, and it reaffirmed that the Fed is going to pause on hiking rates again for the third time in a row. That's all baked into the cake. The big question is, will Fed Chair Powell and members of the FOMC signal that they may start cutting rates sooner in 2024 rather than later? That hope has been underpinning the six-week rally for stocks and other risky assets that we've been riding on. Powell, for his part, has dismissed such notions, but Fed Fund futures traders are not convinced. The CME's FedWatch tool is now showing a 40% chance the Fed will cut rates by 0.25% at the March 20th meeting, and a 50% chance of a 0.25% cut at the May 1st meeting. Get out your bifocals, because we're going to be looking real hard at the Fed's summary of economic projections and the dot plot this Wednesday afternoon. Those will tell us where the voting members of the Fed think rates should be at this time next year. And that leads us directly into our Big 10 for the week, not our Big 3. We're going to give you Investopedia's top 10 terms of 2023, the most popular finance and investing terms you were searching for all year. Sarkalit. 2023 will leave us with a lot of memories, many of which we might like to forget. It was a year that brought us several bank failures, a spike in treasury yields and borrowing costs, questions about the future of the US dollar as the world's dominant currency, and the rise of artificial intelligence threatening to disrupt every industry it touches. For investors, 2023 also brought us a recovery in the stock market that seemed hard to believe, even as the bond market continued to tumble into a three-year bear market. Old rules of investing were questioned, and for many, hopes of achieving their financial goals were thrown into doubt. Through it all, however, our millions of monthly readers kept searching for ways to understand the market and economic dynamics that shaped this year. Here, then, are Investopedia's top 10 terms of 2023. Number 10, racketeering. This criminal activity always seems to find its way into our most searched terms of the year. Racketeering charges against former President Donald Trump brought by the Georgia court drove the headlines this year, but there were several other high-profile cases that got our readers' attention. Shein, the popular e-commerce fashion platform, was sued for racketeering by three independent designers who claimed the company stole their designs. Number 9, assumable mortgage. The spike in the 30-year fixed mortgage to more than 8% this year made home buying impossible for many would-be buyers. The U.S. housing market has been in a deep freeze for all of 2023, forcing buyers and sellers to get creative about how to make a deal, including using an assumable mortgage. That's effectively transferring the existing mortgage from the buyer to the seller as part of the transaction. If interest rates are indeed going to be higher for longer, expect this crafty strategy to become even more popular next year. Number 8, BRICS. As the U.S. Treasury market continued to spiral lower and tensions between the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. and China heightened, there was more talk of the rising dominance of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as global superpowers. The dominance of the U.S. dollar was also questioned as OPEC and its allies floated suggestions about moving away from the dollar as the de facto currency in the oil markets. The rise of the BRICS was a popular topic for our readers and will likely be for years to come. Number 7, Treasury bill. Alexander Hamilton's creation got a lot of attention in 2023 as Treasury prices slid into their third year of a bear market and the public's appetite for them was called into question. The Federal Reserve's unwinding of its balance sheet also put trillions of dollars of T-bills back onto the market as part of its quantitative tightening regime. This disruption in what was traditionally thought of as the safest and most widely held asset class on the planet drove our readers to learn more about how the Treasury market actually works and how to take advantage of the higher yields these government bonds offered. Number 6, the debt ceiling. Sadly, threats of a government shutdown as the government approached the debt ceiling made their annual return as members of Congress could not come to terms on approving continuing resolutions to fund the government until the very last minute, once again. They did it, but it cost the House Speaker his job, and the can was simply kicked down the road again, guaranteeing we'll see this term again next year. Number 5, inverted yield curve. This dislocation in the U.S. Treasury market lasted all year long, bringing threats of a recession and a bear market with it. We got neither, but the inversion of the 2-year and the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield was but one of several dislocations in the Treasury market that befuddled investors throughout 2023. Given the economic uncertainty in front of us, yield curve inversions might just be the new normal for a while. Number 4, certificates of deposit, CDs. 2023 offered savers a real choice for their safety nets, and certificates of deposit were among the most popular products. As banks offered higher yields to keep pace with the Federal Reserve's rate hiking campaign, our readers were learning everything they could about how CDs work and which banks were offering the highest yield at the moment. Number 3, artificial intelligence, also our readers' number 1 pick for the year. The future went mainstream as AI became the hottest investment theme of the year and the most terrifying, fascinating, and controversial technology we've encountered in decades. AI became a dominant element in every industry it touched, and it touches a lot of them. Our readers were learning about how it works, the opportunities it presents if used effectively, the pitfalls it presents, and of course, how to invest in its potential. Number 2, bank failures. Banks are supposed to be boring, but they were anything but in 2023. The failures of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic shook the financial world and sent savers in search of a better understanding of if and how their money is protected. Our readers became experts in the role of the FDIC, how the Treasury supports the banking industry, and the real dangers of how and where banks invest their money. And number 1, the American dream. The term American Dream actually originated in the depths of the Great Depression in 1931, coined by the writer James Truslow Adams in his book Epic of America. He described it then as a dream of a land in which life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to ability or achievement. Today, it's typically used to refer to a collection of milestones like buying a home and a car, getting married, having kids, and prospering economically. Yet the dynamics of the past year made a lot of those accomplishments seem too expensive for so many people. Saving money, investing money, owning a home, raising a kid, sending them to college, and building wealth were really impacted in 2023 because of inflation and that big spike in mortgage rates. That put the so-called American dream out of reach for millions of Americans. Let's get set up for the week ahead. And it's all about the Fed. Fred, tell your Uncle Ted. The Federal Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve meets on interest rates this week with the decision coming on Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. There's almost a 100% chance the Fed will pause for the third meeting in a row. Inflation is getting pretty close to 3%. The job market remains strong and consumers are hanging in there, at least for now. But it's what Jerome Powell says about when the Fed may lower rates in 2024 that we're going to be paying attention to and why the Fed may feel the need to do that. We're also going to get the latest updates on consumer and producer prices this week with the release of the Consumer Price Index on Tuesday and the Producer Price Index on Wednesday. Those should also show a continuing slowdown in inflation, which will only embolden the Fed to stay put and start thinking about lowering rates in the first half of 2024. The earnings calendar is fairly light as we come up on the last few weeks of the quarter, but we will hear results from widely held companies, including Costco and Darden Restaurants, the owner of Olive Garden, to name a few. Those garlic knots slap, by the way. On Thursday, Intel will host its AI Everywhere launch, where the company will launch its fifth generation Xeon processors for data centers and Core Ultra processors for laptops. There's a lot of hype around AI, as we all know, and Intel and other chip makers have been riding that all year. Shares of Intel up more than 60% so far this year. If you need any more evidence that risk is back on the menu, look no further than what's happening with cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin, the big dog at the crypto bowl, is on one of its magnificent streaks, rising 163% so far this year. Nearly half of that surge is coming in just the past 6 weeks. Ethereum is up 85% this year, and even Dogecoin is back on its next lunar voyage of sorts, up 30%+. Is this just crypto reacting to the drop in treasury yields and the idea that the Fed may start cutting rates sooner next year rather than later? Or is there something else brewing under the surface of this asset class, if you can call it that? Let's get into it with one of our favorite luminaries in the space and a frequent voice on this podcast. It's Rick Adelman, the founder of DACFP, the Digital Assets Council of Financial Professionals, one of the leading experts on financial planning and retirement in this country. He's a best-selling author, a highly sought-after speaker, and a good friend of ours here at Investopedia. So good to have you back on the show, Rick.
Oh, it's always a privilege to be with you, Caleb. Thanks.
So from your perspective, and I know you're watching this space closely for the last decade plus, what's behind the rally this time? Is there anything we can point to besides what I said?
Yeah, there are two specific things going on. First, in about 6 months is the next Bitcoin halving. This is an event that occurs once every 4 years where the number of Bitcoins that gets produced every 10 minutes gets cut in half. We currently produce 6.25 Bitcoins every 10 minutes. That number drops to 3.125 somewhere around April, May. Every time this has happened in the past, the price of Bitcoin has skyrocketed, both in the months preceding the halving and in the months following. So that's one issue. The other, more urgent, more current, more timely, is the fact that everybody is widely expecting the SEC to finally say yes to Bitcoin ETFs. These have not been available in the marketplace. We've been asking for them for 10 years, and it looks like in the next 4 to 6 weeks, the SEC will say yes, and there is a huge buildup of anticipation with that news. And that's causing, I think, the most immediate reason for the big increase in Bitcoin's price.
Yeah, our listeners have been following this closely on the show. We've been talking to Grayscales of the world and waiting for this moment to happen. We know BlackRock, Fidelity are all going to be offering some form of custodianship. That's a pretty big deal. I want to get into that, but back to the halving for a second. Bitcoin is often considered valuable because of the scarcity aspect. There's only going to be 21 point something million of them ever created. So when it halves, what does that mean? More supply ultimately, Rick? What does that actually mean for investors looking at it from a stance?
It means that the supply growth rate is shrinking. We produce currently 6.25 Bitcoins every 10 minutes. That number gets cut in half. This is programmed into the Bitcoin blockchain. It's immutable. It's the way it's going to be for the next 120 years. And it simply means that the total that you mentioned, 21 million that will be ever produced in the entire life of Bitcoin, that number doesn't change. So it's anti-inflationary. And with a fixed supply, that means as there's increased demand, that creates price appreciation. And that's a big motivation for people to be investing in Bitcoin.
Great. Very well explained. Let's talk about the correlation aspect. It used to be thought that Bitcoin was correlated with other assets like risky stocks or fast growing stocks, right? We do have this notion that interest rates are going to probably go down sooner than later, potentially next year. The Fed may be done. Looks like it's done. And we have this sort of easing of 10-year treasury yields, which were popping pretty hard here in the last few, in certainly in October, which led to the downdraft in the stock market. What is the correlation relationship with Bitcoin and these other asset classes, particularly interest rates and particularly what's happening with growth stocks?
Well, historically, one of the big benefits of Bitcoin is that it is a wonderful portfolio diversifier, meaning that it has traditionally been non-correlated to all other asset classes, stocks, bonds, real estate, gold, oil, commodities, foreign securities. Bitcoin has been uncorrelated. Its price movements have nothing in common with any of those other asset classes. So if you believe in modern portfolio theory and you follow the efficient frontier, you love the idea of adding to the portfolio an asset that zigs when others zag or zoom or zilch or do whatever it is they do. And that's been a really big benefit of Bitcoin. During the pandemic and in the year following that, that non-correlation story disappeared. Bitcoin, as you noted, began to track tech stocks. So as the NASDAQ 100 was moving, Bitcoin was moving in sync with that. That was a short-term aberration. That movement only lasted about a year. And now Bitcoin is back to its traditional non-correlation behavior. So it's a wonderful way to increase the diversification of the portfolio. That means you can actually use Bitcoin to, this is going to sound weird, Caleb, you can use it to lower the risk of the overall portfolio. That sounds weird because Bitcoin is so incredibly volatile. How can you add a volatile asset to a portfolio and use it to lower the risk? That's the benefit of the efficient frontier and modern portfolio theory.
I would love to see how this plays out over time because it does not seem like a relationship that would make sense right now. Let's get back to the Bitcoin ETFs. They're really spot Bitcoin ETFs and everyone's lined up to offer them. We know the folks at Grayscale may convert their trust into an ETF, but how will the spot Bitcoin ETF actually track Bitcoin better than what's out there today?
Well, it's not that it'll track it better. It'll track it at the same as. The big concern that the SEC has had is how do you price Bitcoin? I mean, we all know that if I want to buy a share of IBM stock, we are all in agreement as to what the price is because IBM stock only trades in one place, the New York Stock Exchange. And it only trades, you know, during trading hours, Monday through Friday. But Bitcoin is more like toothpaste. What is the price of a tube of Colgate? Well, Safeway might price it for one price, but 7-Eleven has a totally different price. And that is more like Bitcoin. Bitcoin trades 24/7 all around the world. Who knows exactly what the price of Bitcoin is? It depends on who you ask, where you ask, when you ask. That has been very concerning to the SEC because they are concerned about investor fairness. Is the price you're getting for your Bitcoin the fair and legit price? This is why the big movement in the new ETF applications has been something called a surveillance partner. What these ETFs are doing is saying to the SEC, we're not going to try to price Bitcoin ourselves because we're a conflict of interest. It's not our expertise. Instead, we're going to partner with a third party, an independent, objective organization. They are going to do surveillance of the entire Bitcoin marketplace on a global basis. They're going to do it 24/7, and they're going to tell us what the actual price of Bitcoin is at 4 p.m. every day. This is going to solve the SEC's concern, we believe, about identifying the actual fair price of Bitcoin. So this surveillance mechanism is new, it's innovative, and the SEC seems to like it a whole lot.
Is the surveillance part of this being done by an exchange like the NASDAQ? Are the big exchanges going to get involved in this? Who's ultimately going to be the watchdog here?
There are a variety of companies that are doing this, and the different ETF providers are all choosing one or another. The CBOE, for example, is one. Coinbase is another one. So they are all choosing one or another surveillance partner, and the SEC has to bless who they're choosing and recognize and agree that their methodology is valid. But that seems to be accomplished now. And so we are very hopeful that this box will be checked and it will resolve the SEC's long-running concern about pricing of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been kind of a rough year for those who've been watching what's happened in the crypto space from a legal perspective. FTX went down. We all know about SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, and what happened to him in terms of him being charged with crimes here. Binance was sued. Now they're apparently setting up a watchdog. Is the crypto space safer because of this? When we talked, I think a couple of years ago, it was, look, remember the highway, remember the car. Until there was rules, you had fatalities all the time. Have we had these now, so to speak? And is the industry itself, the space for investors getting safer because of what's already happened?
Yes, very much so. I think we're going to turn around in the future. Look back at the day that Sam Bankman-Fried was found guilty of all seven counts of fraud. That will be our March 9 of 09. If you remember back to March 9, 2009, that was the low of the credit crisis. You don't know what the low is until you turn around a year later. And that's, we're going to turn around a year from now and say, yeah, Sam going to prison, being convicted is our low. The crypto bros are out, they're gone. The professionals have stepped in. Former Wall Street executives, former federal regulators are all now engaged in today's crypto companies. They're providing professionalism and, more importantly, adult supervision. These are mature, responsible professionals who are operating these businesses the way they ought to be operated. And I think as a result, the world of crypto is much safer today than it ever has been.
there is going to be more oversight that's already happening. If the SEC approves this, then you have kind of the biggest watchdog on Wall Street looking into this. But this kind of, in a way to me, Rick, seems a little antithetical to the way that Bitcoin was created as a decentralized network, not on sort of the modern finance grid. But now it's kind of entered that. If you got Fidelity and BlackRock offering custodianship, if you got the SEC looking at this, if you got brokers and index companies like the CBOE involved, is this decentralized anymore, or is this now part of the modern financial system?
Yeah, the technology remains decentralized. Then that technology, really Bitcoin is just software. And that decentralized feature allows that software to operate better, faster, cheaper, safer than traditional software. But once you get past the software and you start to use it in business application, the companies that are using the software are very centralized. They are not decentralized at all. So you're absolutely right. Satoshi, the inventor of Bitcoin, the master plan of replacing the global financial system with a decentralized structure, that ship has sailed. That party's over. There's no way that's going to be the case. We got 5% of the world's population to buy Bitcoin on a DeFi model. But if you want to get the other 95%, that is CeFi. That is centralized finance. So the fact that the world's biggest banks and brokerage firms and asset managers and governments are all engaged in crypto today, they're doing it on a centralized platform. Love it or hate it, that's the way it is.
Yeah. To wit, Jamie Dimon, the chairman and CEO of JP Morgan, was out recently saying that he hates Bitcoin. And if he would wish the government would block it, you think that's going to ever happen, or is really the cat out of the bag, the horse has left the barn? Pick your analogy. Bitcoin has gone mainstream, and even the biggest bank in the world and the CEO of that bank is not going to be able to stop it.
He's not only not going to be able to stop it, everybody recognizes him for the conflicts of interest that he clearly displays. Jamie Dimon recognizes that Bitcoin represents an existential threat to his bank because Bitcoin allows the movement of money faster, cheaper, and safer than he can do it at JP Morgan. So he's trying to get rid of a competitor, quite frankly. There's also speculation that Jamie Dimon wants to be the next Treasury Secretary, and Elizabeth Warren has a key say in who that's going to be if a Democrat is elected in November. So Jamie is frankly kowtowing to Elizabeth Warren, which is why he said it in the hearing, because Elizabeth doesn't like Bitcoin and Jamie is playing her game. Let's keep in mind, though, that JP Morgan is one of the biggest users of blockchain technology. The JPM coin moves $1 billion a day around the world for JP Morgan's institutional clients. So when he says he wants to ban it, he really ought to take a look at what his own company is doing, because they're one of the biggest users of blockchain technology.
So we talked about others, Fidelity, BlackRock, allowing custodianship. For me, or our listeners as end investors, some of us work with advisors, some don't. What does this mean for me that they are offering custodianship? What does that actually mean, practically speaking?
It shows that crypto has gone mainstream. When you have BlackRock, State Street, Fidelity, Franklin Templeton, Schwab, the list goes on and on, Global X, Invesco, when you have these huge companies engaging, creating products that are based in Bitcoin and blockchain technology, when you have ETFs that allow you to buy this in a regulated SEC supervised platform run by the biggest asset managers in the world, this is telling you, you know what? It's safe to get in the water. This isn't the murky gray zone that we had 10 or 15 years ago. And this creates a lot of comfort for investors, and it's going to result in a massive asset flow into this, which is why it belongs in a highly diversified, long-term oriented portfolio.
We know that you are offering through DACFP a terrific webinar on December 13th at 2 p.m. Eastern time. Is the crypto winter over? And you're offering CE credit to advisors and planners. Folks, we know you have a lot of you on the podcast. Check out Rick's webinar next December 13th, 2 to 3 p.m. Go to DACFP.com to check it out. All right. So when we spoke to you last, you also emphasized, and you were right, it's not just the cryptocurrencies. They're kind of the cars on the highway. That's the analogy you used with me, and I'll never forget it. But there are the picks and shovels around blockchain and around DeFi that are really important. And a lot of these, especially the publicly traded stocks, have gone bananas this year. Some of them are up 300% plus. I'm talking about some of the brokers, the Coinbases of the world, and others. Where would you be looking to invest in the picks and shovels aspect of it now in 2024?
Yeah, there are a dozen or more ETFs already on the market that do the picks and shovels route. And to your point, Caleb, they don't buy Bitcoin or any other digital asset. They buy stocks of companies that are in the blockchain space. Companies like Coinbase, which is the largest US crypto exchange, digital asset banks, Nvidia, which makes the chips that the Bitcoin miners use to mine Bitcoin. So you can be directionally correct without having to be precisely on point. And that's what these crypto ETFs allow you to do. So rather than trying to pick the individual stock, I mean, should you buy Coinbase? It's already up 300% this year. Why not be more diversified and buy a crypto ETF? They're available from Global X, Invesco, Franklin Templeton, Fidelity. They're widely available from Schwab as well. So I believe in diversification. I'd rather own a basket of 100 of these stocks than trying to pick the one or the two that might prove to be the winner.
You and me both. And if you're right about the SEC approving these Bitcoin ETFs, and if this rally continues, you better believe, folks, that we will see a lot of crypto ETF commercials at the Super Bowl come February, March of this year. All right. Finally, for those folks that are working with their financial advisors, and I know you do a lot of conversations and help financial advisors with their clients with this, what questions should I be asking my advisor if I want to be invested in crypto, or if I have some right now? What are the two or three things I got to clear with them?
I'd want to know if my advisor currently, personally, owns any digital assets. Because if they don't, that to me says that their head is in the sand. They are being dismissive of this new asset class. And if they aren't personally engaged in it, then how can they effectively give me advice about it? Because the questions that I have is, should I invest? How much should I invest? And where should I invest? If my advisor isn't currently engaged, how much knowledge do they have? Are they able to help me at all? The second thing to ask the advisor is, are they familiar with crypto taxation? Most people, even those who own Bitcoin, have no idea what the tax rules are. And that's because this is a new asset class and it doesn't work always the same as stocks and bonds. So you need to make sure that you're dealing with an advisor who has subject matter expertise in this brand new asset class. We offer our designation, the CBDA, Certified in Blockchain and Digital Assets. Thousands of advisors have enrolled in this course. You want to make sure you're dealing with a financial advisor who is knowledgeable about this asset class and therefore able to give you the advice that's in your best interest.
And if you hadn't noticed, folks, the IRS has been asking for a few years, right after you put your name right under the top part of the 1040 form, whether you own any cryptocurrencies. You better believe that'll be on there next year as well. Let's go out on this. You know, Investopedia is a site built on our investing terms. You're a crypto expert now, even though you're a broader expert across personal finance. But I got to know, what is Rick Adelman's favorite crypto term right now to share with our listeners?
It's got to be stacking sats. There are 400, 500 million people around the world who own Bitcoin. But quite frankly, almost none of them own Bitcoin because Bitcoin is right now $44,000. Who can afford to buy a Bitcoin at 44 grand? Most people don't buy a Bitcoin. They buy a Satoshi. Well, what's a Satoshi? Well, we know dollars. A fraction of a dollar is called a penny. Same thing in Bitcoin. A full Bitcoin is $44,000, but a Satoshi is 100 millionth of a Bitcoin. So you can buy a Satoshi for pennies. And in fact, the overwhelming majority of people in the world own Satoshis. You own enough of them, you end up owning a Bitcoin. You have enough pennies, you get to a dollar. So stacking sats, meaning accumulating your investment in this space so that you're buying Satoshis on a regular basis, dollar cost averaging. Eventually, you'll have so many of them, you'll actually own a Bitcoin. Stacking sats is my favorite term.
We love that term. And if we don't have it on Investopedia, it'll be there next week. I can promise you that, folks. Definitely check out Rick's webinar upcoming next week. Is the crypto winter over? He's offering CE credit again to advisors and planners. But if you just want to come in as an investor and listen, do so. 2 to 3 p.m. December 13th. Sign up at DACFP.com. Rick Adelman, the founder of DACFP.com and a good friend of ours at Investopedia. Thanks so much for coming back on The Express. We appreciate you.
Great to be with you, Caleb. Have a great holiday.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing and finance term we need to know this week. But I think we've had our fair share of terms this week, haven't we? Instead, we're going to give you a number to know this week, and that number is $3.4 million. And that is the cost of the so-called American Dream, our top term for 2023. Now, everyone's idea of the American Dream is different and unique. There's not one dream, there's more like 330 million of them. But if you put real numbers to the cost of reasonable things a household might want or have to pay for in order to raise a family of four in this country, that's kind of where you end up, $3.4 million. Investopedia's data journalism team tallied the cost of life stage events like getting married, raising two kids, buying a home, owning a vehicle, paying for a couple of years of college, health insurance, funerals, and pets, and retirement savings, and life gets really expensive. The thing is, the average lifetime earnings of Americans across all education levels is approximately $2.3 million. That's over $1 million short of the estimated cost of the so-called dream. So we either need to earn more, spend less, and invest to make up that difference if we want those things in our lives. We don't have to have any of them. Your dream is yours. Just make sure you know what it will cost and how you intend to pay for your American dream. The Investopedia 2023 Term of the Year. Thanks for joining us this week, as always, and special thanks to Rick Edelman for climbing back aboard the Express. We'll link to his upcoming webinar on what's next for crypto this week. We'll also link to our 2023 Terms of the Year breakdown and our American Dream calculations. You'll find those, along with all the other reports we cited, in the show notes, and get those wherever you ride the Express and on Investopedia.com, the Express podcast. Let's get Fetty this week, and we'll talk again a little further on down the line.